Zaki, a lot of your work seems to have evolved in some way, your early work anyways, from out of the women's movement and from out of early experience with the women's movement. Can you talk a bit about how that encounter affected what you wrote, the content of what you wrote?
Okay, that's pretty significant. I went to a women's college on purpose because my high school was such a Grand Central high school that when I and other women in my class would win, would do well, we wouldn't get the prizes because in my high school they literally believed that the boys should have them. So I said, well, I'm not ever having this happen to me again. So I went to a women's college. While I was at Barnard, I met a woman named Tulani Davis, who, with me, published in 1970 our first book of poems, which is called Fat Mama, which is a collection of about 8 women from New York that we knew who wrote. And the reason we did that was because between 66 and 72, there was a vast movement that we called the Cultural Nationalist Movement for the black people in the United States. And a lot of the tenets of the Cultural Nationalist policy had to do with the fact that women had nothing to say and weren't, in fact, supposed to speak. And as an intellectual person at that point, and also as a progressive person, I resented that immensely. And I wrote, I demanded to write because I was also part of the movement of the black people towards whatever consciousness raising we have reached up to date. And I could not believe that anyone really wanted us to believe that women had nothing to say. And from there, when I went to California, it was like going to heaven because there were actually feminist centers, there were women's writing workshops, there were women's presses, there were women's poetry groups and centers, all of whom helped me because I got work that way, I got readings that way, I made friends, and it had incredible emotional and artistic support.
You say that you consciously segregated your work for a while and
wrote
for the women's community.
I certainly did because I didn't have anything to say to men. I mean, I had been in situations with the Afro-American Students Association, with the Panther Party, with the Young Lords, who, even though the Young Lords had in their party platform that sexism was also to go out of the new world, that didn't necessarily manifest itself. And after years and years of working so hard with all the groups I had respect for and finding out that all they really want me to do was go to bed and be a nice lady in the night and carry some coffee, when I had worked so hard to be an intelligent and scholarly person and thoughtful, that creates an incredible rage, and I don't want a sharing of it.
There was some talk, I remember, in the late 60s, early 70s, that in the black community, the women's movement was a divisive factor, and it was different than in the white community. What did you think about that?
Well, I don't think like that. I think about things that I need. I happen to know that I needed abortion services. I happen to know that if I ever had children, I would need daycare facilities. I happen to know, because I was married when I was 19, that I needed laws in New York State changed because I had no property in New York State, still in 1968, and if I left him, then I was going to leave penniless for things that I had worked for, too. I knew that if I was in New York State, that if I said that my husband, whom I had become estranged from, had raped me, I had no way to go to court with that because I was property. Those kind of things may affect white women more if, I don't know who could possibly think that. If you're in the world and you're female and you live here, everything happens to us, and especially if you're black and Latin and you have less financial stability, more things happen to you that are debilitating. So anyone who says that it's divisive would simply like to see women who are weak and dependent, and I am not interested in seeing anyone weak and dependent.
For Colored Girls is filled with resentment with women voicing their feelings about being ignored, about being mistreated, about not being loved enough.
Mm-hmm.
There's a section in it which is called No More Love
right.
Poems. I was then really surprised when reading your new volume, Nappy Edges, to see the volume opening with some really beautiful love poems. I'd like to ask you to read one of those, if I may.
Oh, I'd love to read it. There's a whole bunch of them, but I'll read one. You see, I think this is The Kisses Are Flying or Mississippi Meets the Amazon.
The Kisses Are Flying.
Oh, okay. They're sort of a duet, but I'll do Kisses Are Flying. This is a female seduction song, by the way. I mean, that's how I see it. The Kisses Are Flying is a woman's way of a serenade. It's my perception of my serenade. It's happening, but you don't know about it. These kisses are clandestine. No one can see them. I hold them in my hand. Should I be discovered, I stick them in my hair, and my head gets so hot I have to excuse myself. Under no circumstances can the legs that slip over my hips leave telling marks or scents of love. This would be unpardonable. So I am all the time rubbing my arms, exposing myself to river mist to mask the sweetness you leave me swilling in. I can't allow you to look at me how you do so. I am naked and wanting. I can't allow you to look at me how you do so. I am naked and wanting to be explored like a honeysuckle patch. When you look at me how you do so, I am all lip and thigh. My cover gets blown and the kisses run free, only to hover sulking over my cheek while I pretend they're not mine. 'Cause it's happening, but you don't know about it. The kisses, they take a slow blues walk back to me. In the palm of my hand, they spread out, scratch, kick, curse, and punch till my skin cries. The kisses are raising hell in my fists. They're going to fly out mad and eager. They're going to fly out mad and eager if you look at me how you do. Oh, if you look at me how you do so, I am naked and wanting. If you look at me how you do so, I am all lip and thigh. They're going to fly out and climb on you. They're going to fly out mad and eager and climb on you. The kisses are going to fly out and climb on you if you look at me how you do so. Oh, why you look at me how you do so? I have all lip and fly. Kisses are gonna climb out and climb out and climb out and crawl all over you.
That's from Zaki's new volume, which is called Nappy Edges. I love that poem, but I was saying I was really surprised to hear the real change in tone from the bitterness and For Colored Girls to the just like really full love that's expressed in there. Is that a change in you, or is that just a kind of, well, there's good and there's bad, and
well,
you can write about both?
There's love poems in Nappy Edges side by side with the new ones that are from the same period I wrote No More Love Poems in. No More Love Poems is very specifically about not calling what I call neurotic dependency love. And in the United States, it's very easy to mistake a very peculiar sort of addiction to someone for love, because we don't have any other words to call it. So we call that loving someone, but that's not it. We're acting out some other needs we have that we haven't worked out yet. Because I think the whole title of No More Love Poems is very long, and I think it says something about, or since I can't love you well enough, or since I can't love you the way I want to, let somebody else do it. That's what it was.
When I first heard No More Love Poems, I thought that it was maybe, too, a statement about poetry, that poetry was so frequently a vehicle for saying these beautiful things, and, you know, for words that embrace other people, and that you were going to subvert that and use it for really angry statements and, you know, to just have edges all over.
Right. I didn't see why I should be giving all this love out in the world if nobody was going to take care of me. I mean, it's a very personal, selfish reason. I was tired of giving out all these wonderful things, making everybody so happy, and I was going to get the shaft of it. So in No More Love Poems, I essentially did, I think, what every adult person has to do, which is to set the limits for our negotiations with other living people. And I set my limits with For Colored Girls. I said, these things here, you aren't doing with me. So if you have to do those things, you should go over there.
You also, in Nappy Edges, write about poetry itself and compare that to jazz, to music. I'd again like it if you could read an excerpt from that beginning part where you talk about music and poetry and musicians and poets.
Okay. you don't resist Count Basie because he's from Red Bank. I never heard of anyone disparaging Eric Dolphy for being born and raised in Los Angeles. Is anybody mad at Miles Davis because his father was a doctor? Nobody's peeved with Pacheco because he's from the Dominican Republic. But I can tell you who was a poet from Chicago. I could say that's some West Coast stuff or a New York number, and there will be a great nodding of heads and uh-huhs, because we don't ask a poet to speak personally. We want a poet to talk like an arena or a fire station, to be everywhere all at once, even if we've never been there. But especially if we've never been there, we expect a poet to clear a space, not her space, not a secret, not a closed room, but the town. We assume the poet to be the voice of everywhere we are not, as opposed to being everything we are. though what authentic musical criticism of our artists that exists always allows them the space to be themselves. A.B. Spellman did not write a book called Bebop. He wrote a book called Four Lives in the Bebop Business. In black music, Leroy Jones demanded only that each apple core be singular, be, in this case, himself, though that had more to do with circumstance than sexism. My basic premise is that poets address themselves to the same issues as musicians, but that we give the musicians more space to run with, more personal legitimacy than we give our writers. And that's essentially the thrust of that essay, is about that if the black people would take the time to know their poets as well as they know the tenor horns, then the white people would have to stop calling us an illiterate culture or a rhythmic culture or a culture that's based on culinary art, you know.
do you think that's a likely thing to happen? I mean, because in a way it's easier to hear music to a lot of people, I think, than to hear words in a poetry context.
There's nothing easy about listening to David Murray or Julius Hemphill or to Hammett Blewett or to Reggie Workman or Chico Freeman. It's not easy. Charlie Parker was never easy. Coleman Hawkins wasn't easy. The Kansas City Six wasn't easy. Fletcher Henderson's band played some of the most intricate arrangements of American known to American music now. That stuff wasn't easy. It was familiar. And it was essentially, it's the same thing that I noticed that a lot of the black kids are doing now. When they walk around with those headphones on their head and they play our music, they're playing our music, so they have some place to be in. It's a significant indictment of American culture that the only place young black children think they can live in is in the sounds that their own people make. They don't live on the soil or in their house. They live inside the music that they get off these earphones.
Well, usually the music coming off those earphones is disco and not David Murray or...
No, but that's why I'm saying that I'm trying to push all of it to another level so that, in fact, David won't have to go to Paris to hear 2,000 people singing his songs like he did. He can be able to stay here. That's why I always try to use new music with all my shows, and I'm always trying to talk about them because I don't see that listening to them is any easier than learning how to read.
Does your poetry, when you're writing it, aim for a rhythmic quality that's similar to, you know, the vanguard of jazz today?
I used to think I was an alto saxophone, and I wrote like that. I think you can see it like in poems like "Some I Ran Off With All My Stuff" sounds like that. Some parts of "No More Love" poems sounds like that to me. But now, see, I'm studying the violin myself with Ramzi Amin, who works with Cecil Taylor, and I've become more of a violin. I think in Nappy Edges you can find a lot more, there's a lot more subtlety, and there's a lot more double entendre stuff going on than in For Colored Girls. And I think my instruments just changed because that has to do with my growing up as a woman, because I played the violin until I was 20, and then I stopped, and then became enamored of the young men and started sounding like one of them. And so last year, I kept talking to Chico and David about giving me saxophone lessons. Then I realized I didn't want to play a saxophone. You know, I had always liked to be with men who played saxophones, but I didn't want to play that. I wanted to play a violin, so that's what I'm doing.
So how's that working out, going back to it after
a few wonderful years? It's absolutely wonderful. I love it. I've been practicing. I have some pieces from Butch Morris that were on one of David's records called Joanne's Green Satin Dress, and Oliver Lake gave me the score to Alto Violin and Heavy Spirits. It's, I think, on one of his records. And Ramsey is an incredible violinist, and he's been with Cecil about a year now. I'm very happy.
You have, in For Colored Girls, you combined your poems with music, music that, by the way, is different from the music anyone would hear were they to listen to the soundtrack recording.
Right.
And I know that you've just come out of working with David Murray in a studio recording poetry and music. What are your aims there in the coming together of both those mediums?
What I'm trying to do is free the language. I've been working on the new pieces. I'm working on this piece called From Ochre to Greens, which is a suite of 12 poems. And that Oliver's scoring with Michael Jackson. In that piece, there's a poem that says that it's absolutely essential that we get underneath words. Because I think in English, it's very easy to speak cheaply. In other words, we can be very nonspecific and think we said something specific. And what I'm trying to do with when I work with music is to let myself know what all is in this word. What all can I get out of it? It's as if when you play a note, you want to find out how many different ways can this note function? How many different ways can it sound? So if I take the words and work with a single instrument, I like to do solo work, I mean duet work. With a single instrument, it makes it almost essential for me to put the weight on the words that they have, and not to string the thought together immediately, but to take each word as a solitary and sacred incident.
Now, how would that work with the horn player who you're playing with? Are you both going to be just sounding out different words in different notes?
No. Okay, see, now, one of the things I like about the black people from the slavery time is that they were very specific because they had just learned English, so they were talking and they would say exactly what they meant. And one of the things I read in Eileen Southern's book that has an incredible collection of essays about us and our music is that when the black people talk about violins, and violins, by the way, is a footnote, violins, French horns, and fifes were the most frequently played instruments by the slaves. But when they would talk about the violins, they would say that the violin's really talking, you know? So when David and I play, or when I work with Chico, or if I work with Michael, I'm talking to them. When I play my violin with Jeronimo Gonzalez, Eddie Danone, to their records, we're talking back and forth. So that I'm dealing with what I'm hearing that's nonverbal as a word. It's a word to me. He is talking to me.
One of the differences between, you know, music and poetry or words is that words have that specificity. Mm-hmm. They refer to specific things. I mean, like nouns refer to objects,
right.
And you know, adjectives can refer to like textures,
right.
and just
exactly.
qualities of objects or
but
emotions.
They also refer to places of origin. They refer to, if you say table, that means you have to have an idea about wood. It means you have to know about trees. You have to know about glue, maybe. You have to know about nails. You have to know about gravity. You have to know carpenters. You know, so like, you, even though words have that specificity, they also open up like a sound opens up. And what I want to do is open up the words so that if I say table, we can not just intellectually have it, but we can intuitively see all the stuff that went into getting that. I mean, the word and is really formidable because it changes someone's entire universe. And means something else is coming. And see, those implications are lost to us a lot. You know, that's why we don't have a lot of respect for language.
Saki, can I ask you to read another of your poems?
Mm-hmm.
And this is, again, I'm in the studio with Saki Shange, and this is, again, from her new volume of poems, Nappy Edges. If you're just tuning in, Saki Shange is also the author of Four Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide.
Let me see. Okay. All right. Let me see. I'm trying to figure out what I want to read, but I can't decide. Oh, I know. I think this one is, I don't want to do that one. Da-da-da! I should sing for you, maybe. I should have brought the violin with me.
Do you sing?
Mm-mm. Oh, I sang one song. I sang like over the waterfront where my aunt works at the Chelsea Place in New York. I've sung it three times. But, oh, here's a funny one. I like this. This is called Just As the Dell Vikings Stole My Heart. The Dell Vikings, by the way, was a doo-wop group from my childhood. The other thing I'm trying to do with my work, which the musicians do, is to create create different cultural resources for the new world. Because we know if someone's been dealing with Art Tatum or with Charlie Parker or Lester Young, and they have their own legacy that we can say a new tenor person came in. I want to do that for whatever third world poets come after me, so they won't continually be searching and not having roots. So I all the time use as many colloquialisms, as many familiar places and familiar attitudes of third world people in the Western Hemisphere as I can, because I live here and my family's been here for 400 years, and there's no need for me to be running around looking for artistic roots, you know. So the Dell Vikings are now in American poetry as a reference. Okay. My fairy godmother retired with the Brown versus Ferguson decision. She reasoned I was divested of my separate but equal status and was entitled to whatever little white girls got from whoever they got it from. Since she was raised in greener pastures and knew the devil only in the blue sawdust of a raunchy dawn, a cruel dance on the edge of a dime, she retired. She wasn't about to miscegenate her powers, integrate them either. She left me to fend for myself. I felt her absence from the moment she escaped with my love of who I am. Conjuring myself through catcalls and mailbox cherry bombs was not my forte. I learned only by breaking the law. I am separate. I am equal. I live my own little rock, cover my back anywhere I want to go, and I go anywhere I want. Crackers were born with the right to be alive. I am making mine up right here in your face. Why don't you go ahead and push me?
Before you read that, Saki, you were talking about, you know, having references mm-hmm. here in this culture that yeah. poets could draw on. What about Africa? Do you relate to Africa at all, you know,
as yeah, significantly. So, I have a problem, though. I don't like the former English colonies upset me. There's something about British colonialism that I find culturally devastating. It might be my New World person. It might be my Francophone person. I have all intentions of spending time in the Ivory Coast and Senegal and Mozambique and Angola because I speak French and Portuguese, so I feel very at ease there. I don't feel good usually in former British colonies in the Caribbean or in Africa. I don't feel good about it. My reason for basing myself in the Western Hemisphere is because the conduct of colonialism in Africa was so incredibly different that I have decided that I'm a New World person. I've been here a long time. My blood's all mingled in the New World. And it's important to me to not make the same mistakes that were made before. We had people in as early as 1840 trying to go back to Africa. Liberia is right there. We all didn't go. Marcus Garvey tried to go back. There were people from my own period of time, from the 60s and early 70s, who did, in fact, go back to Africa and find out that they were dealt with as Americans, and that, in fact, we are Americans. And what we have to do is insist that what we have done in this hemisphere be dealt with culturally, which is why I support virtually every third world artist I can ever meet. I try and make us all do better and do more because we've been usurped by people who came after us, brought what they brought and covered all our stuff up. And it's not fair, and it's also dishonest, you know.
Who are some of the people who you respect a lot who are writing poetry now?
Jessica Terre Haute Hagedorn, Tulani Davis, June Jordan, Carolee Sanchez, Geraldine Kudaka, Janice Mirakatani, Laureen Marr, Lawson Inada, Ishmael Reed, David Henderson, Clarence Major, Victor Hernandez Cruz, Josiano Figueroa, Pedro Pietri, Pablo Melendez, Mikey Pinheiro, Miguel Agarin, Lois Griffith, Earlene Smith, Toni Morrison. I could go on and on.
Who are some of the people who whose reading of their work made mm-hmm. you really want to write too, or helped inspire
you? For sure, Imamu Baraka's readings I love. I also love Victor Hernandez Cruz and Jessica Hagedorn. I have a friend in California named Paul Vane, who's a remarkable reader, stuff I love to listen to. Who else? That might be about it. I forgot Miguel Lagarin. I love because he sometimes has to break out into song. Because he's so excited. And we have another friend, a Chicano friend from California, whose work is gorgeous, whose name is on the tip of my tongue and I'm not getting it out. It'll come to me in the next 5 minutes.
Okay, well, you can mention it when it does. In a self-interview that you do with yourself mm-hmm. at the beginning of your book, you talk about how you used to want to be an ICAT.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and you said that you always knew how to shake that thing.
Oh, I always did.
No, I would really like to know, I mean, now, you know, given the years that you've spent as a mm-hmm. feminist, mm-hmm. when you go to, I don't know how many R&B concerts you go to.
I go to a lot.
Okay.
I just saw the Commodores. I just saw Patti LaBelle. Uh-huh. I go to a lot.
So when people are shaking that thing mm-hmm. up on stage, is that, how does it move you now, you know, and do you get into, like, aspects of sexism and stuff in both stage antics and lyrics of pop?
Well, see, now that's where culturally feminism has different aspects, different meanings for white women and black women. Black people have always, as the white historians have documented thoroughly, been sensuous. They've been discussing how we used to shake around all the way in Congo Square in New Orleans before the Civil War. That's part of our culture. Our bodies are different to us. We are able to move rhythmically and sensually from a very early age. And it's not sexist in the sense that the men and the women do it. The Delphonics are just as sexy and shaking around as the Marvelettes ever were. Who else? Smokey Robinson is certainly not any less sexually available in terms of fantasies than Tina Turner is. So there's a dual thing going on in our culture, which means that we all love to parade ourselves. We're not in any way being insulting to one another. The white singers used to present themselves as goody two-shoes, both the men and the women. So, of course, when the women started shaking around, then that would, in fact, be in your culture a sexist proposition, whereas for me it just isn't. It's enjoying your body and yourself.
There are some disco albums and even jazz albums, or at least former jazz musicians, who are coming out with things that kind of like go beyond sensual movement, I think. Like,
oh, but those are covers. Those are not performers.
Right.
Now, see.
So you're going to separate,
I do not think a Playboy bunny or a go-go dancer has anything remotely to do with a phenomenon like Tina Turner or Aretha Franklin. This is just two different things. I mean, we listen to Tina Turner because she can sing and because her body's gorgeous when she sings. But she don't walk around naked in the street, you know, or in a nightclub just walking around naked. She's not selling her body. She's giving us how she best presents what she does. And it's fun and it's wonderful. And they work hard.
In For Colored Girls, one of the women has a passage where she talks about going to meet Willie Bobo at a party, and he doesn't show up, and she's really angry and bitter at having been stood up in a way.
By Willie Colon.
By Willie Colon, that's right, and that becomes kind of like the epitome of Spanish music and Spanish subculture to her. So she switches and starts listening to Archie Shepp. How did you start listening to the avant-garde of jazz?
Well, I did both of those things at the same time because I was raised by a father and mother who, the way they took care of their estrangement from America was not to deal with it. So they essentially just introduced all the rest of the world where black people did other things. So I was surrounded all the time by Latin music and by jazz, which is also another indication of alienation from that period. Was bebop is a very cold, cold number. It's movement in constricted space. And then, of course, the cool school was not what we would call a rah-rah sis-boom-ba number. So I was raised in it. I mean, when I grew up, I just kept buying records because it was logically there for me to do.
So you just kind of like naturally grew into...
Well, I grew up in it, literally. My father, I think the first dates he took her on was to see Dizzy Gillespie and Fletcher Henderson's band and Lunsford band. I knew Miles Davis was raised in East St. Louis. Dizzy Gillespie, in fact, used to visit our house. Duke Ellington stayed in our house. Du Bois stayed in our house. I mean, we had connections to the art world because my father was a painter as well.
As well as a surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
And now music still is an important part
of
your work, and
yeah.
But you haven't just like limited yourself to a specific kind of music. You still go to...
I still go, oh, yeah. I was going to go to La Magonette to see Orquestra Novelle because I want to see Jerónimo González, and I still go see Pacheco whenever I can, or Celia Cruz. I love it. And I've worked with Conjunto Libre before. I love Hilton Ruiz. I mean, there's just no way for me to separate that out. I tell you, I'm from the new world.
You know, it's interesting. When I listen to For Colored Girls, I think, well, the woman who wrote this must have really suffered a lot because she understands the quality of big suffering and small suffering and is able to express it so well. And I meet you and you're a really beautiful woman to my eyes and had what sounds like just a really wonderful period of growing up, you know, with great parents and Duke Ellington staying at your house. And
well, I was a little kid, though. I mean, I just always a man. Another man was in the house. But, okay, that's because appearances are very deceiving, number one. Secondly, I have what you call... anybody who studies astrology knows that most of my planets are in the bottom hemisphere of the chart, which means most of my activity takes place in my unconscious. And therefore, I feel things with great, great intensity and almost anything. it was really funny. I was sitting with my friend the other day on a bench, about a 20-foot bench, you know. It was cushioned and everything. And a man very gently sat down at the very other end of it, and I literally jumped because I'm just so attuned to everything that happens to me that I don't miss anything. And it's the not missing of things and the taking of every, learning how to give things proportionate value that took me so long, because I would just experience everything with the same intensity, and it was all very intense. And it took me till at least I was 27 to figure out, well, I don't always have to respond to everything, but I can know it and see it. You know, and that just took a long time.
How do you relate to feminism now? You no longer, as we said at the beginning, segregate your work, perform only for mm-hmm. and only to women. And the new work that is published now, some of it is very women-oriented. Mm-hmm. Some of it is love poems. Right. Some of it is, you know, not right. person-oriented.
What I do now is... I do the same thing I always did. I still work with whole groups of women. Sometimes I just don't want to work with men. I find that it demands other parts of me that I don't want to give up sometimes. Sometimes I might just work by myself in a women's studies center, because it's really gratifying to me, and it helps me to grow, because of the fact that women who are like 20 now have had 10 years of active feminist arts available to them, which makes them like very, very ahead of me in some ways, and I like to talk to them. And then I work with men when I want to. I love working in nightclubs, and unfortunately at this point we don't have a lot of women's groups available for me to work with. I'm dying to work with Isis and with Linda Tillery's band. I really like both of them. I just haven't been able to hook that up yet. But I think at this point that the most important thing I can do is be available to those people and those groups that I have respect for.
Can I ask you to read a last poem for us?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Let me see. Okay. Oh, this will show you. I can get very risque. I get very frisky. I get to be a frisky person. You could just take what he's got for you. I mean, what's available could add up in the long run. If it's music, take it. Say he's got good dishwashing techniques. He might be a marvelous masseur. Take it. Whatever good there is to get, you should get that and feel good. Say there's an electrical wiring fanatic. He could come in handy someday. Suppose they know how to tend to plants. If you want somebody with guts, you could go to a rodeo, a prize fight. A gang war might be up your alley. There's somebody out there with something you want. Not all of it. But a little bit from here and there can add up in the long run. Whatever good there is to get, you should get that and feel good. This one's got kisses, this one can lay linoleum. This one likes wine, and that one fries butterfish real good. Say, there goes an anarcho-musicologist. This one wants Pushkin to rise again, and that one has had it with the past tense. But whatever good there is to get, you should get that and feel good. This one could make music roll around the small of your back, and that one jumps up and down in gardens. It could be yours. There really is enough to get by within this world, but you have to know what you're looking for. Whatever good there is to get, you should get that and feel good. You have to know what they will give up easily. What's available is not all that's possible, but there's so much fluctuation in the market these days. You have to be particular. Whatever good there is to get, you should get that and feel good. You could snatch it and feel good. You could grab it and feel good. You could steal it and feel good. You could reach it and feel good. You should, oh yes, and feel good.
Thank you very much.
No, you're welcome.
I've been in the studio with Zaki Shange. You probably know her as the author of For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide. There's a new volume of her poems published now. It's called Nappy Edges. Thanks again very much for being here.
Oh, thank you.